watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren, and welcome to listeners of KSOW in Cottage Grove, Oregon. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, the economics and politics of sustainability. We know and have known for several decades that we are polluting our air, water, and land. We know that our fossil-fueled society can't continue as it has been because it is destabilizing Earth's climate, and we know that even as demand for petroleum is escalating, the globe's finite supply is diminishing. Why, then, do our national political systems seem incapable of making the fundamental changes we need? What kind of changes are they? And what can we do as individuals and communities to take action? 2 weeks ago, New York State Greens sponsored a three-day festival in and around Ithaca to discuss the problems of sustainability and to demonstrate solutions, as well as share skills for sustainable living. We're first going to hear a panel discussion from that Green Fest that featured three speakers: musician Dan Hill, the Cayuga Nation representative to the Haudenosaunee Environmental Task Force; Art Weaver, founder and proprietor of Renovus Energy of Ithaca; and Virginia Rasmussen of the Project on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, and former mayor of Alfred, New York. We'll conclude the program with an excerpt of a talk from Julian Darley of the Post Carbon Institute. We'll begin with words and music from Dan Hill.
I've thought of things to say all day, as I knew I had to talk on sustainability. So the problem has been long overdue. I am Cayuga. I belong to the Heron clan, and I live up at the share farm in Union Springs. And that's the first residential area that we've had in 200 years. The other properties are commercial. We're fighting a gaming interest within our nation. So some of our nations are for the casinos, some aren't. Because it does have a bearing on sustainability and what you do and how you're treated in this world and how you treat the world. This flute is made out of cedar and it has 8 notes to it. And I made it to be like a saxophone so I could play a lot of notes and play along with the blues. I found out after I made this that there's an 8-note flute in Wisconsin and the Ojibwe areas, Anishinaabes. That's 200 years old. So I wasn't doing something first time. I wasn't doing something somebody else was already there before me. But it reminds me of water. The bottom note has a warble to it, like a spring, bubbling water coming up. And so the song that comes out of this is called Aquifer, because we depend on water, we depend on it to be clean, and I would imagine most Native people would have a zero tolerance to residue in the water. If you have an industry, nothing should be going back into the water, because somebody else drinks that water. Somebody else even needs that water. We leave contaminants in it. Everybody lives downstream. Watching somebody on TV today, and they were out in the cold, and you could see their breath coming out, you could see the moisture coming out of their mouth. For me, water is very important. I enjoy being in the ocean. I feel cleansed, and I have to go there at least once a year. Going back into the water is in many places religious. They go bathe in the Gandhi. They go all over the place. They make treks. They sweat in the sweat lodge with water, with steam, to cleanse their bodies. What we leave in the water is going to get to us. I was waiting to do a TV program in Tonawanda at the Iroquois Wildlife Refuge. It's out past Batavia. And I'm sitting there watching all the ducks because it's migration time. And I'm looking at a pool of water, and somebody's car had left oil in the water, and had a sheen, that swirl that you can see when you drink hot coffee in styrofoam cups. You see that swirl? You're drinking that, controlling it. How much is it going to take for that sheen to stop that process of osmosis, which creates the clouds, which creates the rain, which creates the streams, the lakes, and the swamps, and goes back into the ocean? How much of that sheen is going to stop that? Driving through Minnesota, coming through Wisconsin, from Wisconsin Dells all the way to the Illinois state line, I kept smelling smoke, brush fire, and it was from the Colorado fire that killed all those firemen on the ridge. Downwind, downwind. This is Minnesota white cedar, and it's at least 15 years old before I made it into a flute. It was sitting as lumber next to somebody's garage. And so it's real soft. You can dent it with your fingernail, and it's real easy to carve. But the moisture's gone from it. The tone that it makes is kind of devoid of moisture in its breath. And I hear that. I don't know if you will notice that, but as I've been making flutes for 20-some years, and I play them, I notice, I can almost tell where they're going to be in sound when I put it together and make the holes, and somebody wants a particular sound, I can come real close to that. But this one is well on its way to becoming earth again.
As you all know, the theme of our gathering this weekend is sustainability. And so I'd like to get started. We have three sustainability visionaries here this evening. And we've heard from one already, Dan Hill. So he started his presentation early on, and he's going to finish tonight's presentation as well. Our first speaker is Art Weaver. Art is a founder of, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Renovus Energy, Inc., a renewable energy systems design built firm based in Ithaca. This is a rather long intro about Art, but prior to his work at Renovus, Art was a staff scientist at the Cornell High Energy Synchrotron, I think, conducting research in X-ray biophysics and proteomics. He also has an MD from Mayo Medical School. He'll speak to us tonight about social change and its connection to renewable energy.
First of all, I want to thank the powers that be for inviting me to speak to you all tonight.
So it was a surprising invitation. I'm not a member of the Green Party, at least not yet. I've tried to remain independent. independent of all political affiliations. And I know a large number of people share that view. Whether or not it's the appropriate view in our day and our age, I am not certain. I'm definitely not a politician. I'll give you some background, but then I definitely want to stop talking about me. I'm basically an introverted scientist type who was very content working in a laboratory and, you know, on the mysteries of life and trying to understand how things work at a sub-microscopic level. And that's all very intriguing and such, and you can convince yourself that you're contributing to the knowledge and the understanding of our world and so on, and that's what scientists are very good at doing. They're very good at deluding themselves that their work is valuable. Largely, the work that most scientists do is not valuable in the least. It ends up being so much paper being put away into archives that no one will ever look at again, by all odds. There are some bright, shining stars in science, and I commend them, and they probably ought to remain doing what they're doing. However, scientists are known for their minds, hopefully for their creativity. And some years ago, prior to founding Renovus Energy, I saw far, far too few of them even wishing to think about the problems that were becoming ever more apparent in our world. I had a hard time understanding why people who were so intelligent, who had, you know, IQs off the chart, who had these wonderful letters after their name, could not see what was just so glaringly obvious to me. I still have trouble understanding this today, although I have a little more insight. Now, it says this is a sentence I wrote in that biography. All of us, and I believe this applies to everyone here, we get up in the morning, we look at the day, and then we end up focusing on the details. There's this propensity that we all have to focus on the thing right in front of us that needs doing right now, whether it's an unhappy child or a car that needs fixing, something that distracts us from larger thoughts. And the day just goes on like this, where we focus on one detail to the next, to the next, to the next, and we say, I'm too busy to think about anything else. In fact, I don't want to. It's too exhausting. The problem with that is that you'll never think about anything else. You'll always be focused on the details. You'll never think, except in passing or at convenient moments, about the problems that our community faces, this country faces, that the world faces. And that's a failure of our elders, I suppose, to have educated us as to what's important to focus on. I became frustrated enough that I quit my job at Cornell and founded this little company called Renovus. We do nothing else but install renewable energy systems, solar, electricity, solar thermal, small wind turbines, even the occasional micro hydro electric generating system. Okay? It's fascinating work. It's not quite as intellectually stimulating as Cornell, or academia, I should say. But it presents its own set of challenges. And as my wife, Barbara, would say, it has taken even more time than I ever spent in the laboratory to manage this group of nine people that have come to work with us and for us. Anyway, what I'm trying to do is explain to you why I would choose to leave a very quote-unquote secure kind of position that was, just had a ridiculous salary associated with it to an uncertain future, one that makes Ithaca's technical living wage, but that is far from a living wage, as anyone who is in that income bracket knows. So I've learned something about the issues that beset lower-income people on a very personal level. It's not any fun, but the challenges remain, and solving the challenges is what's fun. That's what turns me on these days. All of us are capable of solving problems. We see them around us all the time, the little problems to the big problems. But I promised I'd stop talking about myself. What does renewable energy have to do with social change? What does it have to do with the Green Party? I think everyone here understands that renewable energy used to be called alternative energy. We don't call it that anymore. It's renewable. It's sustainable. It's not alternative. You should just drop that word from your vocabulary. Call it renewable from tonight forward. While I'm thinking about it, and I'm just extemporizing here, I'm sure you can appreciate it. The other term people tend to use is to talk about the environment, as if it's separate from ourselves. Let's all speak of it from tonight forward as our environment, as if it's connected to us. Let's use the personal pronoun. It's such a simple change, but words make a difference. Let's talk about our environment. When we meet people and we have these conversations, we'll talk about, well, you know, your environment has some issues. Your family's environment. It personalizes it. And that's the core of what I wanted to talk about. I'm very skeptical about the ability of politics and politicians to do very much. The Green Party is a noble enterprise. I have, you know, no qualifications about that. We also have to think realistically in the back of our minds. What's possible for the Green Party? Maybe in many years, it will become a powerful force. It is not that right now, but the potential is there, and that's good. So there's skepticism that I have. What I am not skeptical about, and which I have a deep appreciation for the great power that exists, is in each one of you. You each go about your lives. Every day you get up and you do something. The details of our lives, right? We make choices every moment to moment, about what we're going to do. None of us, including me and my family, are living sustainable lives right now. No matter how green you think you are, you're not living that way. We're driving these vehicles that we put fossil fuels into. That is unsustainable. Is anyone here driving a purely electric vehicle? No one here yet. You will be. That's what it takes. You must. Because that's what it takes to be sustainable if you're going to move around. Charge off your solar panels or your business's solar panels or wind turbines arrayed out around the community or micro hydro turbines that don't also impact the other biota of the streams. These are very, very difficult
things to achieve. We can take steps. We can take little steps. We can, you know, we can. Some people choose biofuels, fine, or now. Some people choose hybrids. Well, that's a step, but they're very expensive, as we all know. But there are a million other choices that you can make. Whenever I walk into any room, I sort of look around. And I say, okay, what's not sustainable about this situation? One glance. Anyone here ought to be very familiar. What are all these light bulbs doing on? Each one of those is how many watts? Can anybody hazard a guess? 60s, maybe. How many of them are there?
Too many.
No, how many? 10
for each one?
10 per, and how many lights? So we have 120 60 watt bulbs. They're not all filled, but 120 times 60, 7,200 watts, 7.2 kilowatts, just to provide lighting for this room. They're not even providing much lighting. They're providing a lot of heat. Does this room need any more heat? Yeah, you see the things. Somebody hasn't thought about this yet. Who is that person? Everybody. Anybody who's ever walked into this room. This is the first time in this room for me, but now at least all of you know about it. Maybe the organizers will tell them. You know, somebody might know about this after tonight, but this is unacceptable. This is not sustainable. There's a million things, a million situations we all get ourselves into each day. We can say, that's not sustainable. Can I do anything about that? Surely. Some people act, some people don't. Some people say, I'm too busy. I can't do anything now. I'm on my way to here. We can all do stuff. We can. There's, I attach the phrase to every email I send out to people. It's a saying attributed to Gandhi, but was probably said before that. He said, you must be the change you wish to see in the world. You, not your neighbor, not the government, not your politicians, you. If you haven't fixed your own life first, you have no standing to say, oh, it should be like this. When is it going to be like this? If everyone fixed their own lives first, we'd be living in a paradise right now. If everyone thought about the things that they do, the unsustainable practices they have, the world would not have problems. I'm convinced of it.
That was Art Weaver of Renovus Energy in Ithaca.
Anyway, our next speaker will be Virginia Rasmussen. Virginia is a principal with the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. She previously directed the education program at the New Alchemy Institute on Cape Cod and headed the Environmental Studies program at Alfred University, Alfred, New York. Virginia co-founded the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILPF, campaign to challenge corporate power, assert the people's rights. She lives in Alfred, New York, and has served as mayor of that village. She will speak to us tonight on the politics of sustainability.
And thanks, too, for the invitation to be here tonight, and also for the invitation to think deliberately about this business of sustainable politics, because surely this will be at the root of our capacity to live sustainably. And what I want to talk with you a little bit tonight is sort of an odd combination of something very grand and something, in the end, that has to be very, very practical. So in a way, it follows very nicely, I think, on our last speaker's comments. Because if we are intending to adopt ecological technologies and to recognize and live within the limits of a finite planet, and to bring the fairness, justice, the community, and citizen rights necessary to live sustainably, that a new kind of political process is certainly in order, and I think it is something we have scarcely begun to think about. Common sense tells us all that a systemic, fundamental response is needed to address the ecological and social breakdown enveloping us. Yet many of us in the environmental field, in the social change field, continue doing what we have always pretty much done. We deal with an issue here and an issue there. We assume we know the nature of the problem, and we struggle hard and then harder. On a playing field we have not built, by rules we have not written, rules that are solidly stacked against us. And as we all know, we've frequently gone on ad nauseum, describing in fuller detail with data galore the old problems, and then the new problems, and then the newest problems. Not that it's particularly easy to get at the roots. Daily we face forces of denial that are more brazen and more militant than ever. Insidious religious doctrines that foster dangerous ignorance and superstition. Ever-growing corporate rule that denies us any access to the power of decision-making and governance. And a virulent patriotic ideology that makes us all shudder. This is a tough reality to try to change. Bill Moyers pointed out, and some of you might have read this in one of his talks, that when ideology and theology couple, their offspring are not always bad, but they are always blind. And getting the blind to change directions is even tougher than getting the bad to do so. So how might a sustainable politics break into this seemingly vicious downward spiral? I'm going to suggest four basic aspects of our cultural political lives that I think require great focus and evolution if the search for a sustainable politics is to reward us. They are each one about relationship within the work of governing ourselves. We'll have to address each of them because the one we do not address will undo any gains in the other three. Each is politically fundamental to the creation of sustainable communities and the sustainable lives of people who live in them. None is new to you. Some effort in each has already begun. But there is great need to bring these basic aspects of political life up front, provoke rethinking and a dedication to these four tightly connected, determining aspects of any sustainable future. Let me state them briefly at the outset. First, can we bring up front, include in our work and conversation, the fact of our present dominator, patriarchal, industrial worldview that drives us inevitably towards inequality, violence, war, and earth destruction? Only a tireless commitment to comprehend, counter, and change it will stand us a chance. And we have to talk about it. Second, an alternative worldview is inadequate in itself to the task of evolving a sustainable politics. That worldview will have to find its expression through real democratic processes. Is it possible that through our work and conversation, the fraud that is our current so-called democracy can be made clear to an entrenched, indifferent middle class, along with a will to build the real thing, a radical democracy? Third, What good will establishing a radical democracy do us if we can't sustain it through our capacity to do democracy? Might we bring up front in our work, our teachings, a valuing and a learning of the arts and skills of doing democracy? And fourth, what good will our capacity to make skillful democratic decisions within a people-centered democracy do us if we have no authority as we the people to put those decisions into policy, law, and governance? In the short time I have, let me elaborate briefly on each of these very fundamental aspects of the work ahead. A sustainable politics calls on us, in the words of Adrienne Rich, to understand the assumptions in which we are drenched. This is prerequisite to knowing ourselves, and it's prerequisite to being able to change ourselves. The present dominator, patriarchal, industrial, anti-ecological, war culture, anti-democratic, call it what you will, worldview, too long with us and too little acknowledged, will block and then annihilate every sustainable measure and attitude we place in its ferocious grip. We have to pull this conversation into the forefront of most every issue we take on, government or corporate, community, and even personal. That wrong-headed worldview defines who we believe we are. It tells us what our nature is, who we think we can be with one another in the earth. As long as we do not hit head-on this limiting, frankly, terminal, dominant worldview, we will continue to see human beings as what that worldview assumes us to be: primarily individualistic, acquisitive, competitive, selfish, and generally quite nasty. Of course, that serves those who would just love to rule over us, doesn't it? If we're that crummy, we better have strong and powerful rulers to keep everyone sufficiently at bay from everyone else. I share, however, the resolute view held by Anne Scales in her book, The Emergence of the Feminist Jurisprudence, when she says, "It is insane at the end of the 20th century to adhere to the belief that people are innately horrid and can do no better. Rather, we must recognize that our fears of contingency, of dependency, of unimportance have put us on a suicidal path." But what good will this nearly opposite worldview and assumptions about ourselves do us in regard to sustainability politics unless we apply them within a very different understanding of democracy? Many in the country have been falsely, intentionally colonized with untruths about democracy. Lawrence Goodwin, in his book, The Populist Moment, says, "We are culturally confused and cannot even imagine our confusion. We are culturally organized by our society not to rebel, not to understand protest, and most importantly, not to understand the prerequisites of democracy itself. Might we be able to help ourselves and others decolonize our minds and promote an understanding of and commitment to radical democracy, which means, by the way, nothing more than real democracy. People really ruling themselves, that's all. Democracy, according to Douglas Loomis in his quite wonderful book, Radical Democracy, is not a kind of government. It's an end of government. It's an ideal a project, the art of the possible, a performance art. Radical democracy, says, is an adventure of human beings creating with their own hands and hearts, I might add, the conditions for their own freedom. It's a way in which people order their lives together through discussion and common action on principles of equality and justice. Democracy is not what so many have come to believe in this country. It is not handing your power over to people in exchange for promises. Political parties have a role in education, but they do not make the people's decisions. It is not just rulers looking out for the people's welfare. It's about people ruling themselves. It's not economic development or a stage of development. It's a form of political rule. It's not the free market or free trade, deceptive language for global corporate rights law that divides society into rich and poor and is utterly inappropriate to democracy. It's not the U.S. constitutional system, which was opposed by radical Democrats of the time as putting too much power at the center and giving too much power to the rich. It's not free elections, although they can play a democratic role. And it's not allowing the people to have their say. The right to dissent is not power. The right to dissent is not the right to decide. Can we bring these wrong, even dangerous perceptions of democracy up front for people and begin to shape the real thing for ourselves? Establishing radical democracy is not some leap of consciousness, says Loomis, into an uncharted future. Rather, it only means returning to a natural attitude. Our challenge is to break the ideological bonds that prevent us from assuming that natural attitude of democratic common sense. Democracy is in our nature, says Loomis. We can be a primarily community-based, cooperative, less material, and radically democratic species. Since a sustainable politics requires that radical democracy be made real, then the skills necessary to do democracy, to do the art of the possible, must also be made real, must be part of our teaching and learning, and this rarely happens. We hear about the value of diversity, the importance of inclusion and participation, but how often do we hear these values presented in the context of doing democracy, of governing ourselves? When do we learn how to set an agenda and facilitate a meeting that people are glad they came to, much less want to return for the rest of the conversation and the give and take and the decision making? When do we learn the skills of communication necessary to share knowledge and opinion with one another in a way that can be heard, that works for the group, that does not antagonize, and that truly adds to the social learning essential to self-governance? When do we learn the skills of decision-making without losers, where everyone gets to participate and be a part of the outcome? How long will we settle for Robert's rules of patriarchal order? When do we learn the skills of conflict resolution? We need conflict. It's natural. Dealing with conflicts usefully teaches us new things and brings us to a better, wiser place. How many people learn conflict resolution as part of the art of conducting our lives, much less governing ourselves? Without an appreciation of conflict and some skills to make the most of conflict, many stifle their voices, and others prevail by aggressively filling the void. This disempowers everyone. Organizing and planning skills, who learns them? How do we form a group, set goals, determine priorities, hold an event, address accountability, learn how to evaluate our work along the way and at the completion of a project? How do we gain support from others for our efforts? How can we ever do democracy and govern ourselves if we never learn organizing for self-governance 101? A sustainable politics requires that those decisions we make with our democratic skills and mutual work be implemented through a governing system that puts the people in charge. That is, we the people must have the authority to govern ourselves. And let's be clear, from the days of the Constitution on, we have not had that authority. Despite all the mind control and colonization that sends the message that this is a democracy and the people rule. Nevertheless, I mean, there are people figuring that out, of course. I saw a bumper sticker some weeks ago. It said, "Watch out, or we'll bring democracy to your country." Nevertheless, our Constitution hangs on to its unchallenged, unquestioned place of reverence. Most people know little about those passages written by its authors to keep democracy out of the picture. There is positive content in that Constitution, and it's important that we recognize it. There's a system of checks and balances that's absolutely brilliant. And wouldn't it be nice if it were being used now, right? And never before was a nation established on a set of agreements. It's always been, you know, a family line or a conquering hero. This is important, and this is a good thing. Each state was given the right to a republican form of government. They're not giving it to our communities and the people in our communities particularly well, but it's in that Constitution, and we can work with that. But where legal authority over economic and political life is concerned, the framers wrote a constitution that protected the propertied few from the many with ease. The Constitution's principal author, James Madison, saw to it that political and economic structures, and I quote him, would protect the opulent minority against the majority. So the Founding Fathers designed a plan of governance that sanctified the individual and the rights and protections of property, not the community and the rights and protections of persons or the earth. Even though there was no mention of corporations in the Constitution, the propertied class used the property bias of the Constitution to hone the corporate form as its vehicle to concentrate property and wealth. A scheme, by the way, generously assisted by the courts and judges of the 19th and 20th century. Whatever business wanted, business got, business practice and business malpractice became law. Property's legal protections turned into all kinds of legal power over people, communities, and the earth. Not content with that, corporate boards realized that, I'm going to finish something else. When I say the rights of property, what am I talking about? How expansive could this become? Those rights of property gave to the corporate form control over production. Production has to do with property, right? It gave them control over investment. It gave them control over the organization of work, over the development of technologies and their diffusion into the culture. What is this? Production, investment, work, technology. This is our economy. The corporations were granted control over our economic life, and control over economic life is control over political life. Not content with that, corporate boards realized that the designation of the corporation as a person under the law would gain them legal protections from people, because they would be given Bill of Rights protections, 14th Amendment protections, which means now the public cannot even interfere with them. So, power over people through their property, protection from people through their designation as persons under the law. So we arrive at today's corporations, obviously able to do almost anything they wish, and it's all perfectly legal. Why? Because they saw to the writing of the law, the shaping of policy, the defining of every debate, and the election of their favorite candidates in so many cases. What they do is the stuff of governing. It represents historical takings of the people's right to govern themselves. But, and here is a positive sign, because the crisis is systemic, the problems are being driven right down to the local level, where the way is open for the development of new approaches. And in fact, new approaches are being forced onto our communities, and the people are beginning to rise to the challenge. People in their communities are beginning to assume their right to govern themselves. They are waging the struggle to shift the cultures of their communities and rewrite law to serve people and public authority, not property and corporate authority. They're changing the law by challenging existing law. That's how it's done in this country. Recognizing that democracy is without meaning when corporations have constitutional powers to deny to people the democratic process. So in closing, just know that more and more communities are no longer exhausting themselves in the regulatory maze. Instead, they are educating themselves, organizing, learning history, making decisions together, and passing their own laws that ban corporations from owning farmland, from dumping sludge on farmland, from giving money to candidates or referenda within their jurisdictions, from planting genetically engineered crops, from placing any more big box stores in their jurisdictions. Communities are extending rights to nature and denying them to corporations. These people are reframing their issues in terms of democracy and rights, no longer in terms of regulating corporate harms and haggling over permits to pollute. They are building a movement to drive self-governance into communities all over the country and eventually into the Constitution itself. So, while it is so true that sustainable politics requires that we possess the rights and the law to govern ourselves, all the good law in service to people and public authority, should we acquire it, will not survive without attaining a level of success in the other three fundamentals of a sustainable politics, a new partnership or post-patriarchal worldview, a deeper understanding of democracy as radical democracy, and the capacity to do democracy by respecting, learning, and practicing its arts and skills. It's a tall order, but all of this work is underway. So it's our responsibility to get out there and join it whenever we can. Thank you.
Virginia Rasmussen, former mayor of Alfred, New York, co-founder of the Project on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, POCLAD, speaking as part of a panel on the politics of sustainability from the 2007 New York Green Fest held in and around Ithaca 2 weeks ago. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN, Nashville, WUOW, Oneonta, KRBS, Oroville, WKNH, Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. We continue with the panel on the politics of sustainability.
Anyway, I want to invite Dan back to finish his presentation, which was only started at the beginning of the program. I don't know, I didn't mention a few things about Dan. I know he mentioned some things about himself, so there might be a bit of repetition. But Dan is the Cayuga Nation representative to the Haudenosaunee Environmental Task Force. The mission of the Haudenosaunee Environmental Task Force is to help Haudenosaunee nations in their efforts to conserve, preserve, protect, and restore their environmental, natural, and cultural resources.
Part of my presentations are to break stereotypes. I don't know what I'm going to say when I get up here, but that gave me a lead in. How do you greet people when you don't know them? I don't know what nationality you are. I don't know what nationality you are. But me, you always ask, what tribe do you belong to? My chief, did you ever sleep in your teepee? Had an old man come up to me and tell me the joke about the drank so much tea, he drowned in his teepee. And even though he was older than me, I backed him up. And I almost put him through the wall. Because those are things that happen all the time. Still, all the time. I know we don't mean to be that way. We just say it because we're taught that we're not a part of our environment. We're not responsible for differences among us. My teachings, I've used this illustration before, is the way that I talk to you, I should be facing this way, because my environmental and political point of view is backwards to yours. The things that we taught in the establishment of this republic were flip-flopped and changed into what we live with today. The Electoral College was the clan mother's role. The clan mothers could decide who was going to be the chief, and that's their duty. The Electoral College could still say Al Gore won, even though the court cases and all that went, everything was bought. They could have still said, no, we have this vote here. We can do this. Our political system was changed, and they took the women's role and gave it to the men. Everything that we had before was organized through the women, from the woods out, the fields to the house. Was all the women's domain. From the woods to the other nations was all the men's domain. Getting along with other people, trade, commerce, hunting, fishing, all that, it changed. So sustainability, I hear all the comments that you made and the points that you made, and I agree with almost all of them. But I still look at it from a different point of view.